This is Talk of the Nation. Neil Conan is away. I'm Allison Stewart, sitting in Washington. And it looks bad for General Motors. Consider this. Its shares have fallen nearly 90% in the last year. The company is low on cash. And in this economic climate, who has the money for a car anyway, not to mention filling it up with gas? Now, GM doesn't stand alone here. The other two manufacturers that make up the big three, Ford and Chrysler, they're not doing so well either. Will the cavalry come in the form of Congress? That is debatable, literally. Congress is taking a look at a $25 billion loan package this week to bail out the United States automobile industry. For those who say, let them go bankrupt, the company's advocates will tell you if they were to file for bankruptcy, if they were to fail, the economic fallout would be huge. There is the argument that GM, Ford, and Chrysler have been mismanaged and didn't adapt to a changing world, and that bankruptcy would send a clear message to the auto industry that it is time for reform. What do you think would be best for GM and the big three? Bankruptcy or bailout? If you work in the industry, how is this going to affect you? Our number here in Washington is 1-800-989-8255. You can always do the email thing. The address is talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation on our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Joining us now from her office in Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Micheline Maynard, senior business correspondent for the New York Times. And Micheline, we should say we tried to get you into a studio in Ann Arbor, but they were all booked. Imagine that.
Well, I think that the subject is just so popular that every pundit that everyone can get their hands on is rushing to studios to talk about it.
Well,
but
we're
happy to be with you.
We thank you for being, and we call you Mickey, right? Mickey's okay?
Sure.
Let's talk a little bit about this bailout. You say the word bailout, and people's jaws start to clench a little bit right now. What's in this specific $25 billion loan package?
I think, Allison, one of the problems is that we don't actually know what's in the package yet. There isn't legislation that's actually been drafted. We've heard proposals which range from no bonuses for employees who make $200,000 a year or more, no dividends. There's been a suggestion that management be replaced, that the government create kind of a loan board that would oversee this investment that the taxpayers would be making. But right now, we don't even have a summary of the bill, and the discussion is that they might have tried to have a vote on it on Wednesday. So I hope lawmakers get to see it pretty soon.
Do you think that's realistic, that there could be a vote on Wednesday?
Well, the idea is to have a test vote in the Senate and see if it would pass. Okay. And one of the problems is that they'll need about 12 Republicans to vote in favor of it. It's actually been the Republicans who have raised most of the objections to this idea.
I feel sort of silly even asking a question like this, but what can you do with $25 billion?
You know, that is a very good question, because it's not $25 billion for General Motors alone. It's $25 billion divided by GM, Ford, and Chrysler. Now, Ford has said that they have access to capital. They actually have a $10 billion revolving loan that they haven't even tapped. So I don't know, maybe they'd be nice guys and give their money to General Motors, but somehow I don't think so.
So we talked a little bit about the bailout plan, we'll call it bailout. Bankruptcy. There was an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal this morning that said, you know what, these companies just need to be allowed to go bankrupt. Let's talk about some of the pros of filing for bankruptcy.
Right. We talked about this in the Times last week. Actually, the pro is that this is the tool that the legal system makes available to companies that are in trouble. I've actually personally covered six of the bankruptcies at the airlines and two bankruptcies at big parts suppliers. It's a messy process. It reveals a lot of your secrets. On the other hand, you can terminate your labor contracts. You could ask to throw out your pension plans. You can renegotiate all of your contracts. And it really does provide an opportunity to get your house in order, but with a lot of people watching.
So when we think about bankruptcy now, it's more like putting the brakes on. It's not shuttering the doors and moving out of town, and that's that.
See, that's up for discussion, because GM has given the impression that if they filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, which is the reorganization kind, that they actually would slip into a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, which is when a company liquidates. And, you know, I think the experts disagree on whether that's actually true. And, you know, having actually been inside of bankruptcies, I think they would have a chance to reorganize. I think that there are lenders that might give them a hand if they were serious about that effort, but they're trying to give the impression that they would collapse, they would take suppliers down with them, and then possibly the other two car makers.
Are there any other cons, arguments out there?
Well, I think the big con is that this will affect a lot of people who are sort of part of the extended General Motors family. You have parts suppliers who supply parts to the company. They might have to file for bankruptcy. You have workers who would probably not get the benefits that they're used to getting. You have just, you know, the cafes across the street from car dealers that might close. So I think the idea is that there would be a domino effect throughout the economy.
Is that what Senator Carl Levin meant when he said that this is a national problem?
That's absolutely what Senator Levin meant. And I think the point is that a lot of people think of the old auto industry. You know, back in 1960, you know, before some of us were born, General Motors alone had almost 60% of the car market, and Detroit controlled 90% of the car market. But now Detroit has less than 50%, and the majority of cars that are sold in the United States are actually vehicles with import nameplates, like Toyotas and Hondas and Volkswagens.
Now, General Wesley Clark wrote in a piece in the Times yesterday, and he said, what's good for GM is good for the Army, and said that aiding the American automotive industry is not only an economic necessity, but also a national security imperative. What's your response to that?
I thought that was a very interesting point of view, and certainly as a student of the auto industry, you go back to World War I and World War II, and the auto industry was the arsenal of democracy. When they flipped the switch to start the war effort, the car companies stepped up and built bombers and gun turrets and all kinds of equipment for the military. So, I mean, there's an argument that you need the auto industry just in case. On the other hand, we have a pretty big military establishment now in this country, companies like Boeing and Northrop Grumman and EADS. So I think they would be probably first in line for some of the contracts.
Throwing up his hands in the studios is Frank Lanfit, NPR's labor correspondent. Mickey, I'm going to ask you to hang around.
Sure.
Frank, you've been talking to some folks. We were just chatting before we went on the air, some folks from the area. And for them, this beyond all the politics of it, it's so personal.
It is very much, Allison. I think that, and Mickey would know well because she's out there in Michigan, I think that area has been suffering for a long time. And now workers in particular are just seeing something that even a year or two ago they didn't imagine. It's also very difficult because I think in that part of the country, if people want to move and they want to try and find other kind of work, the housing values have fallen so much that I think people are tethered to the area. So it cuts off their options. And I think you can't sort of underestimate psychologically the impact that that has on a region, people not being able to have other choices, being able to move and look for other opportunities.
We were discussing the psychological element of, are we as Americans so invested in the story legacy of the big three automakers and the way they do business, and is Detroit as the Motor City? And are we doing ourselves a disservice thinking that way? Do we need to be thinking about the future and about wind farms as the next big American industry?
Well, it's interesting because I think that there are a couple of things that you said and Mickey said that play into this. I mean, one, as Mickey pointed out, is there are more people buying foreign cars in the United States than there are buying these American-made cars. So to some degree, most consumers actually have in some ways moved on. Mm. They're voting with their pocketbooks. If you look at driveways around the country, see a lot of Toyotas and Nissans and Hondas. The other thing is you've been referring to them as the big three. I've stopped doing that in print. I don't know what the Times does. But they're no longer really very big. Nothing what they were. As Mickey was saying, if you go back to the 60s, I mean, they were absolutely dominant. They were so powerful and so tied to the American psyche. And in the brief time that I've covered, I think if I go back to 2005, at least 250,000 jobs have been lost in the auto industry in just that period of time. And it looks like a lot more will be. One thing that might be interesting is to see what happens on Capitol Hill right now is, if this week there isn't something of a referendum on the relationship between the American government, the American taxpayer, and the Detroit auto industry, because I think you're going to hear some very interesting things. And if it doesn't pass this time around, and it looks like it's going to be difficult, then under an Obama administration, which with more Democratic, you know, help in the House and the Senate, to see if we don't have another conversation and see how that turns out.
Mickey, let me get you in here to weigh in on this idea of the way we think about Detroit as part of American history.
Well, that's right. I'm actually the author of a book called The End of Detroit, which explained how the big three lost their grip on the American car market. And the book came out actually 5 years ago, and even 5 years ago, there were plenty of people who had moved away from Detroit automobiles. Their parents had moved away from Detroit automobiles, and even their kids had never ridden in a Detroit automobile. So we're kind of a generation beyond the day when the Detroit automakers dominated everything in the automobile industry. I mean, obviously, if you live here in Michigan, you think that they're still large and in charge, but the minute you get past Toledo, you can see that the world has significantly changed. So I think they live on in our psyche and maybe in our memories more than they actually do in reality to the average car buyer.
So for me, the average car buyer, as opposed to you and Frank, who are steeped in this, this news seems sudden. The idea that GM would lose 90% of its value in a year. Was it? What, were you surprised when you saw that happening?
I thought it was pretty startling because I remember GM as a $70 a share stock, which would have been only 5 or 6 years ago, and there were people that were talking about GM as possibly in a $100 stock. I mean, the GM was trading with, you know, the Sonys and the Coca-Colas and GEs and companies like that. And today, GM is trading for $3.20 a share.
Mickey, we're going to ask you to stick around as well as Frank Lanfitt, the NPR labor correspondent. We're speaking with Mickey Maynard, a senior business correspondent from the New York Times. We're talking about the road ahead for U.S. carmakers. Is it bailout or bust? Bankruptcy? Bankruptcy, is that an option in your opinion? We'll get to your calls in a moment. 1-800-989-8255. You can also reach us by email. The address here is talk@npr.org. I'm Allison Stewart. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Allison Stewart in Washington. Rick Wagoner, the head of GM, was on television yesterday, and he pushed Congress to act on a bailout for U.S. auto companies. Bankruptcy is not an option. He called it a fantasy, said it wouldn't work. There are plenty who disagree. We've put together a roundup of different opinions on how to retool the industry. It's at npr.org/blogofthenation. We're asking you folks today, what do you think would be best for GM and the Big Three, or the so-called Big Three, as one of our guests says, bankruptcy or a bailout? If you work in the industry, we do want to hear from you as well. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And we're going to go to Steve in South Bend, Indiana. Steve, how are you?
Well, first off, thanks for talking about this. It's really important. 2 points. The country as a whole needs the auto industry in case we ever have to retool in times of war, just like Wesley Clark said. Also, my wife works in the industry at the plant that makes pistons for GM, Ford, and Nissan, a few others for their big trucks. And they've suffered cutbacks in about half their workforce already. And those are good-paying jobs with good benefits that are hard to replace.
And Steve, were you and your wife surprised when you heard the news that GM was in such a tough position?
Sadly, no.
Yeah.
I mean, the handwriting was on the wall. So there are good points on both sides. Why they were still making big SUVs when gas was already, you know, $2.50 a gallon, we had a hard time figuring that one out, too. But they should have been retooling a while ago, but you can't let it go dead in the water. And if you do, then the whole country really is going to be in more trouble than you know.
Steve from South Bend, thanks a lot for checking in and sharing your thoughts.
Cool.
So, Steve, Frank Lanfitt is joining us, our labor correspondent. You were sort of nodding your head when at Steve's point.
Well, one of the things that's interesting is to hear that even people in the industry are critical of some of the management decisions here. And one of the things that I found very interesting about a couple weeks ago, we did a web chat on this very question, and we got over 100 responses. And what was interesting is there were quite a few people from the auto industry who wrote in, and they said some of the same things that Steve said, which is, hey, I kind of saw this coming. I didn't like some of their strategies. And I just want to read you one thing that we got. This is a guy named Bill Hooper. He's an auto parts, works for an auto parts maker in Illinois. And he wrote, he said, "You might think I would doggedly defend my industry and try desperately to hang on to my admittedly great job. But contrary to what you might assume, I don't actually believe the auto industry itself is worth saving if the market won't naturally sustain it." And this is just anecdotal, but I think it's very interesting when you get responses from people in the industry who either say they did make a lot of mistakes, or some people that I've heard from who say, even though this will affect my job, this will hurt my livelihood, I actually don't agree with a bailout.
So Michelle Maynard, senior business correspondent from the New York Times, if all these people seemed to know what was going on, who were sort of on the ground, what happened at the executive level?
You know, I think when you come out to Detroit, you kind of are in a bubble. I always joke that because I-80 runs directly from New York to Chicago, you have to make a right turn to go up to Detroit. You know, it's not sort of on that main path across the country. And I think you look out the window and everything you see here practically is a Detroit-made automobile. And when that's your frame of reference, you tend to think that the world looks the way, you know, it is when you look at it. And I think one of the things that happened is tunnel vision. I think the Detroit companies got a little bit too disconnected from the rest of the country. And I also think that there's just so many layers, not only of bureaucracy, but tradition when you talk about Detroit, that it's really hard to fight through that. I mean, think about it. Think of all the trouble that the auto industry has been in over the last 15 or 20 years, but it was only last year when the companies really sat down with the UAW and made some significant changes in their labor contracts. And this was after losing essentially four-fifths of the workforce. Back when there were a bailout for Chrysler, the UAW did give concessions in both the United States and Canada, but it got the money back. So essentially they had just been making gains on a steady path for over 20 years. And I think, you know, there are a lot of people that are very critical of the UAW, that their labor contract just got so rich and so fantastic for the few workers who were left that it overlooked the big question, which was, is your future based on protecting the benefits of those members, or should they have been a little more reasonable over the years and made sure there was a bigger workforce?
We're going to talk to somebody about that in a minute, one of our callers, but I do want to get a couple of examples from you, Mickey, about when you say they were just so rich and bountiful. Give people an example.
Well, one of the things that the UAW enjoyed until recently was fully paid health care. And there were some co-pays and a few benefits that they had to pay for, but essentially, if you worked in a car plant, your health care was paid for. And the people who worked in offices at General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler didn't even get that. They have some very generous pension programs. There was overtime when the big SUVs were selling. There's legal assistance. There's cost of living allowances. And, you know, it drove the hourly wage, if you fold all of that in, up towards $80 an hour. And that was getting way out of whack with what the actual average labor rate was in the United States. And then when the foreign companies came and built their plants in the South, their average rate, if you fold in their benefits, was closer to $45 to $50. They pay their workers kind of similar wages, but they didn't offer the kind of benefits that the UAW won for its members in all those labor contracts.
With all that in mind, let's talk to Sam from Des Moines, Iowa. Sam, how are you?
Good. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course. Fill us in on what you're thinking.
Well, yeah, basically she's addressing the question I have, but I, watching all the Sunday morning news shows and listening to the pundits and the politicians yesterday, I'm just wondering how much of the argument about GM's poor management is kind of code, particularly by Republican senators. I was hearing is resistance to bailout is really a union-busting tactic, so a lot of that resistance is by letting GM and the other and Ford and Chrysler fail. You're essentially also taking away all the UAW's power. And so while the Southern wages might be competitive now, you know, they'll continue to, you know, part of having the UAW there is propping up everybody's living standard.
Well, Sam, let's see if we can get Frank Langfitt to answer that a bit. What do you think, Frank?
Well, there's no secret that the United Auto Workers were working very hard for Barack Obama in Michigan and up in the upper Midwest. I wonder also, though, if this isn't more of a philosophical argument about capitalism. I think that some of the Republicans, I think we take a look at someone like Richard Shelby from Alabama. He has, you know, a kind of a belief in a Darwinian kind of capitalism, mm-hmm. You take risks, and if they don't work out, you pay for it. So I think there's a lot of that as well among Republicans. So the other challenge, though, for the UAW is they find themselves in a very difficult position right here. If you talk to analysts right now, people say the industry, because the sales have dropped so dramatically, and here's a number that I think is just always worth mentioning. Last year, we sold about 16 million autos in the United States. Next year, it's going to be about 12 million. So the bottom has dropped out of the market, and people believe that the UAW, the workers at the Detroit 3, will probably have to lose at least 30,000 workers. Mm. How Ron Gettelfinger, the head of the UAW, sells that after, you know, a number of givebacks, some really huge ones on healthcare last year, I really don't know.
Yeah, and you know, Frank, what he has said is that the UAW won't grant any concessions in return for this bailout. And I think that statement might have been a little bit unwise. If you think back to the Chrysler bailout, people might not remember that it was kind of a three-legged stool. It was Lee Iacocca from Chrysler. It was Congressman James Blanchard from Michigan, but also Doug Frazier from the UAW. And it wasn't that Doug wanted to give any concessions, but he understood that in order for that to pass Congress, he would have to give up some jobs. And in fact, the UAW lost about 50,000 jobs in return for the Chrysler bailout. And but he understood that if he didn't, there would be no jobs at all.
Well, we have somebody on the line who's in the heart of it all. Her name is Lydia. She's joining us from Detroit, Michigan. Hi, Lydia.
Hi.
So this is going on in your front yard.
Yeah, in my backyard.
In the side yard and the driveway, literally.
Yeah.
What are your worries?
My worry is I think that Chrysler has become big and bureaucratic and the unions are broken, but it probably needs to fail, but this is quite possibly the worst possible timing. I'm concerned about our state. I have a lot of friends and family who are... We're all connected to the autos, and we can't sell our houses, even if we wanted to move, because the economy here really went even further south than it is. We can't sell our houses to move. So how does this happen? How does this get unwound in a way that does not cause the state of Michigan to just implode, which is what we all kind of talk about now?
Do you find that people come down clearly on one side or the other when it talk about going bankrupt, let them go bankrupt, or they really should be bailed out, they really should get some money from the government?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people say, oh, God, no, they got to bail them out. And it's mainly because everyone just looks around and says, you know, restaurants, stores, I mean, people will be in such a world of hurt around here if they just allow them to completely shutter up. But I have friends who say, you know what, they're broken and the unions are bloated and they just, you know, we're just postponing the inevitable if we let them stay alive.
Lydia, thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you.
Someone who agrees with Lydia about postponing the inevitable is Alex, who wrote to us from San Francisco. A bailout just postpones the inevitable. The big three are going to shed a lot of jobs no matter what happens. The auto companies need protection from creditors and clean house. They can terminate their labor contracts and pension plans. Bankruptcy over bailout. Does he make a good case, Mickey?
Well, that's one of the cases to be made. And I want to just kind of talk about what your previous caller said.
Sure.
This whole idea of the car companies shutting down or shuttering or collapsing. I mean, if you go into Chapter 11 bankruptcy, you get the chance to reorganize. And a GM case is not going to be quick. It's going to be a couple of years if it happens. This is an opportunity for them to go in and use these legal tools. I think it will be devastating to a lot of people, but, you know, then some other pundits have raised the idea, okay, we give them a bailout, and then the winter is terrible. They get through to April, and car sales haven't picked up. They've run out of cash. Do they just come back to Congress at that point? I mean, are we going to give them bailout money to pay for their bankruptcy? I mean, that's one suggestion that's been made. It's a very difficult issue. I really don't think it's a black and white issue. I do think that there are a lot of people's lives that depend on this, but on the other hand, they're in business to make money. If they're not making money, you know, these are businessmen. Should they use what's available to them?
Frank, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, I think Mickey made a really good point in that some of the stuff you'll see out there in the press will be talking about massive job losses and the idea that all of these companies would go bankrupt. There's still a market, as I just noted. The market is a lot smaller than it was, but there's still a market for American cars. I mean, people will continue to buy, just not as many. So the idea of sort of this, you know, Armageddon, an auto Armageddon, just doesn't seem very likely. And as Mickey points out, the whole point of the bankruptcy laws is to actually help companies survive. It's not supposed to destroy them. It's supposed to help them make those changes. There's something also that Lydia said that I wanted to touch on, and that is that this is the worst possible timing. And since inevitably these conversations, often there's a lot of trashing of the Detroit executives and the United Auto Workers, there is truth. The management can be blamed for a number of things, but they didn't create the financial crisis. They didn't create the credit crunch. They weren't ready for it. Maybe none of us were. But certainly what they found in these last 2 or 3 months is they've been hit with something that has just been sort of extraordinary. And that's one of the reasons that we're seeing the companies in such bad shape now.
You've been listening to Frank Langfitt, NPR's labor correspondent, and Mickey Maynard, senior business correspondent for The New York Times. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're discussing bankruptcy versus bailout with Frank Langfitt, NPR's labor correspondent, and Mickey Maynard, senior business correspondent from The New York Times. And we were talking about something that was kind of interesting about sort of the mythology of the car companies. But we sort of discovered that here there's a mythology of bankruptcy, that people hear bankruptcy, and a couple of people have called in and said, you know, the shuttering of these car companies, Detroit goes black. And whereas, Mickey, you're saying that this is an opportunity, perhaps, but if we can't get past sort of that emotional wall of bankruptcy, are people going to buy cars from a company that's gone bankrupt?
See, that's the big question. And Rick Wagner, who's the CEO at General Motors, Ron Gettelfinger, the president of the UAW, say no, that there are many other choices out there. If one of these companies files for bankruptcy, the people will be concerned about the value of their cars, and they will go somewhere else. Now, first of all, General Motors has a lot of loyal buyers. General Motors gives a lot of discounts to a lot of people, and there is an option in bankruptcy that allows you to put money into escrow to cover warranty costs. And in fact, the airlines had to do it. Pan Am had to do it to guarantee the cost of their tickets back in, I think it was the early 90s when they filed for Chapter 11. So it can be done. You could have a company like an Auto Nation or Roger Penske step up and say, I will offer free repairs or warranty service to anyone who buys a General Motors car. I mean, honestly, I think as far as an opportunity, they may find out that once they're in Chapter 11 trying to address their problems, that a lot of people will come forward to help them.
I want to get to one more caller on this subject from Delaware. Is it Michelle?
Yes.
Hi, Michelle.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a twofold concern, one about a family member, my 94-year-old grandmother, who's a GM pensioner and who certainly needs her benefits, and the idea that they would be able to dump all of their contracts and leave her without benefits is scary, but the idea that my GM car could not have a parts supplier to, you know, fix parts, it's a year-old car. I hope to keep it for 10 years, as I did my last one, but, you know, I'm wondering, even if they go through bankruptcy, as she's saying, and the company doesn't completely shutter, are we going to be left with not being able to, you know, take care of, you know, the GM products we already have, or take care of my 94-year-old grandmother who won't have, you know, health benefits?
Can I just ask you, was she a white-collar employee or was she a UAW member?
UAW.
Okay, well, she's going to be okay, but, you know, the white-collar folks, the retirees at General Motors, in her group are actually losing their health care benefits. So there are a lot of GM retirees that worked at office jobs that no longer will have health care from General Motors. So,
and it's clear that they were extremely generous, but, you know, at 94, you know, you can't, what are you going to do?
Right. Well, you probably don't even deal with Medicaid very much, maybe once in a while. So it would be very confusing for her, if nothing
absolutely,
else.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And well, then, you know, the idea that, like I said, I'm a loyal GM customer. I love my brand-new GM car that's, you know, working great for me. But, you know, I worry about the suppliers, and I worry about repairs, and I worry about, you know, having somebody who's either going to be a dealer that's going to be there to do the repairs or a supplier that's going to be there to give me the parts, you know, if things trickle down to where everybody's, you know, going out of business.
Well, Michelle, we've got good news for your grandmother out of that phone call.
That's
thanks so
right.
much for calling. Michelle, Micheline Maynard, Michi Maynard, I can't get that right.
Yeah.
Mickey, I'm just going to call you Mickey.
Okay.
Mickey Maynard, senior business correspondent from The New York Times. Thank you so much for spending so much time and sharing so much of your reporting with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I really enjoyed the discussion.
And Frank Langfitt, NPR's labor correspondent. Thanks for coming into the studio, Frank. We appreciate it.
Likewise, Allison. Thanks a lot.
Up next on Talk of the Nation's opinion page, in defense of lobbyists. I'm Allison Stewart. Stay with us. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Now it's time for the Talk of the Nation opinion page. Lobbyists, famous for their five-star lunches and their moral turpitude, President-elect Obama's transition team has refused to take money from them after the infamous descent of super lobbyist Jack Abramoff sullied their reputations. And yet today, from the opinion pages of The Washington Times, a shocking plea on their behalf from Washington lawyer and political analyst Lanny Davis. Lobbyists are good people, too. Davis argues that the problem isn't the lobbyists, it's the absence of transparency. So, out there, if you're a lobbyist, we do want you to call. We promise we won't call you names. We won't give out your email address. Let us know whether or not the total transparency that Davis suggests could work. Give us a call. The number here is 1-800-989-8255. You can always email us at talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation on our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Lanny Davis is here with us in Studio 3A. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks, and glad to be on with such a shocking revelation.
Well, first I need to ask, for the record, are you a lobbyist?
I do very little lobbying, but I do share one characteristic. This is the second shocking revelation with other lobbyists. We are actually human beings.
Really?
This is a headline.
Can you prove that?
Look, the point of my column is that the way that the term is being used is both unfair and inaccurate. Lobbyists perform a vital, some would say indispensable function, which is information and expertise transmitted to people in government who don't have either and need both in order to make the right decisions. They also represent their clients who also, shocking, employ real people with real jobs. And if legislation is going to adversely affect those companies, then under our system of government, those folks ought to have a voice in government. Excuse me.
Would you like some water?
No, I'm okay.
Okay. Was there a point where you can sort of identify where lobbyists became a bad word?
Sure. When a lobbyist gives a politician a campaign donation, the politician, as a result, does something contrary to his or her conscience, that's a crime. Both of them should go to jail, and both have. Going back in American history, that's always been the case, where we have some bad apples that are crooks, and then they make it bad for the rest of the barrel. In fact, most lobbyists, including, I added in my column today, lobbyists for the Girl Scouts of America, Boy Scouts of America, American Cancer Society, and lots of other good organizations, use lobbyists the same way that companies do, to express their perspective as part of our right to petition our government. The problem isn't the lobbying, which is an important function, indeed an indispensable function. It's, as you said in the introduction, the absence of transparency, and I have some ideas on that.
All right. Well, when you talk about transparency, let's define some terms. What do you mean?
I mean full and complete disclosure. I said in my piece the words total transparency should be a redundancy, except a lot of people use transparent, don't really mean it. I mean that what's bad about lobbyists is that people don't know who is paying them and how much money they've given to the politician, and most importantly, what are they asking the politician to do? The politician should want that information publicly available so that when he votes one way or the other, he can say, it's not because of causation, because I've received a campaign donation, which would be a crime. It's because of correlation, meaning that's the way I think as a matter of conscience. The fact that I got a campaign donation is simply a fact side by side with what I did for the right reasons. Politicians are unfairly accused of just because they took a campaign donation, they can't vote their conscience in case their conscience is the same as the donor's request. And that's really where the bad rap comes in. A lot of lobbyists contribute money to politicians, and a lot of politicians take it. That doesn't mean that the politician doesn't do the right thing, but we need full disclosure, take the mystery out of the process, and I think then the bad rap goes away.
Well, if lobbyists are people too, aren't politicians people too? And it would be very, very easy to be swayed by someone who was so generous to you?
You know, I'm not so sure I'd go so far as to say politicians are people too. I'm not that, no, I'm only kidding.
Not that crazy. Let's not go overboard here.
Sure. And the way I end my column is that it's really to the benefit of both. Look, 99% of the people I know in public life are underpaid, overworked, and are honest people. And that's a fact. Both sides, the politician and the lobbyist, would be advantaged by transparency so that everybody would know, be able to judge for themselves, and there's no mystery behind it.
We have a few folks on the line. We're going to speak now with Bud. Bud, you're in Tallahassee?
Yes, that's correct.
And Bud, you are a lobbyist.
Yeah, we lobby for state and local governments and getting money for, from the federal government a lot of times for projects here in Florida.
And Bud, what do you think about this idea of total transparency? Would that work out for you?
That's what we do now anyway. We're in Florida.
Oh, I think Bud's gone into one of those dreaded cell holes, telephone holes. All right, maybe we'll get Bud back on the air. Let's go to Kyle in Greensboro. Kyle, you pose an interesting question.
Yeah, I heard that your guest said something about the value of lobbyists is to provide information to legislatures, but I question how valuable that information can truly be when it's coming from an organization with a known agenda.
Well, it ought to have a known agenda because the reason why we have the right to petition our government is to get our own perspective across to somebody who may be voting in a way that affects our jobs or our lives. So having a perspective or a special interest, as they say, the American Cancer Society, which I noted in my column today, spent $20 million on lobbying in the last 10 years. They have a perspective. They want to help people cure cancer. The perspective is not the problem. The problem is that we ought to know what that perspective is. We ought to know if there are campaign donations. We ought to know that the politician is able to vote his or her conscience, not being influenced by the donation. So I believe the only answer is transparency, not to make a broad generalization about all lobbyists being bad.
What do you think, Kyle? Does that work for you?
Yeah, but I mean, not every lobbying firm is the American Cancer Society. And I would also say that shouldn't we also have transparency when it comes to, you know, where the information that that lobby is providing the legislators with is coming from? I mean, there's a lot of organizations out there that will get some think tank to, say, cook the books on the information that they're providing the legislatures, and that goes into the policymaking and the decision-making that we see time and time again come forward that maybe not be the best.
Kyle, thanks for bringing up that point. Kyle brings up an interesting, you know, you can look at any poll number and come out, set of poll numbers and come out with a different answer. You can look at any set of data and one person says, yes, the sky is falling. And the other person says, but from that data, I see the sky is being held up. What do you think about in terms of transparency of how people get their information that they're giving to our elected officials?
I am sure that there would be a good idea for any written documents that are submitted to a member of Congress to be posted on the website of the lobbyist disclosure form mm-hmm. so that the information can be tested for accuracy. But at some point in time, we have to trust our public officials to have staff who are going to fact check. And if they end up voting based upon misinformation, I can tell you, having done a little bit of lobbying, it's not my practice, but I've done a little bit, that if you get caught saying something inaccurate to a public official, you don't get a second try in that office. So most lobbyists are very careful about misleading people that they're lobbying.
We're talking to Lanny Davis. He wrote an op-ed today that says, the title is it, Lobbyists Are Good People Too. We're putting out questions to folks who are lobbyists or who have questions about it. Lois from East Lansing, Michigan joins us. Hi, Lois.
Hi.
What's your question?
My statement actually is that you people, the lobbyists, that is, have as bad a reputation as Congress has at this point, and I don't think there's any hope that you can be reinstated on a trustworthy level.
Well, I guess the point of my column, Lois, is that anybody that starts a sentence out by saying you people is headed in the wrong direction, because generalizations are usually inaccurate, and I'm sure you don't mean to be inaccurate. You don't mean the Boy Scouts of America or the American Cancer Society when you say you people. You probably mean a lobbyist who represents a company who has a viewpoint different than your own, and I don't blame you. You should oppose that viewpoint to your member of Congress, and you ought to know what the viewpoint is through a full disclosure so you have an opportunity to weigh in with an opposite viewpoint. But I think starting out any sentence with "you people" is a bad thing. Personally, I think it's better to be specific than to generalize.
I want to get back to your point about transparency. We started to discuss some of the ways that we could be more transparent, lobbyists could be more transparent. Let's go through a few.
Well, the easiest and pretty radical idea, but it's so simple I can't believe that it isn't the current policy, is when a lobbyist enters a member of Congress or any executive branch official who's also subject to lobbying disclosure, he ought to be able to, or she ought to be required to sign in onto a computer, live, online. So as you're signing in, anyone who wants to check on can notice you're signing in. You ought to have to disclose what I said in my column, why you're there, what you're asking for, how much you're being paid, whether you've given any campaign donations. That's sort of a minimum. I wouldn't mind doing that as a sometime lobbyist. I want people to know they don't have to agree with my client's perspective, but my client has a legitimate perspective protecting my client's interest. Now let other perspectives weigh in so the congressperson can or senator can make the right decision. So the online real-time disclosure idea, I'm not sure why anyone hasn't thought of it before, or if they have, why it isn't being done. I suspect that some of my lobbying friends might say, you're going too far, but I don't know. To me, it's in everyone's interest to get the cloak of mystery, as I said, out of the name lobbyist, because they really are indispensable in a democracy.
Lobbyists are good people, too, so says Lanny Davis. This is Talk of the Nation. You're listening to Talk of the Nation on NPR, from NPR News. I'm Allison Stewart. Joining me in studio is Lanny Davis. He's a lawyer, a political analyst, and an op-ed writer today in the Washington Times. If you haven't seen it, the title of his op-ed is "Lobbyists Are Good People, Too." You've been very game to be in the studio and take some calls from some of our listeners. Let's check in with John from Miami, Florida. Hello, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
I'd like to make a quick comment that, you know, first of all, you know, it seems like we talk about the horrible, evil lobbyist, but we only hear about that when they represent, say, a particular corporation or industry. Well, you know what? I mean, I work for a retail company, and if a lobbyist represents my boss or my industry, that's probably good for me, too, because I get to have my job and get things better. But we also often don't hear about other groups, maybe labor unions, for example, who are lobbying when they're parts of the political parties themselves, or ones that represent the Nature Conservancy or, you know, Boy Scouts, or people who do good things for the communities. Those are lobbying people, too, and everyone should have a right to represent themselves to our government.
Well, I certainly thank you for saying what I said in my column, and you're absolutely correct. Perhaps we ought to just reinvent the word. I looked up on Google where the word lobbying came from.
Mm-hmm.
And some people think Ulysses S. Grant invented it when he would hang out in the lobby of the Willard Hotel when he was president. And it sort of goes way back. Gucci Gulch is another pejorative. I think if we just thought of it as petitioning government under the First Amendment guaranteed right to go to government when government might be doing something that affects you directly or indirectly, and we had full disclosure, we might be able to get rid of this, I think, silly argument that all lobbyists are bad or that all lobbyists are good. They represent particular interests, and we leave it to our legislators to decide what's the right thing to do.
John from Miami, thanks, John. I think maybe the elephant in the room on this subject is the amount of money that it costs to hire a lobbying firm and the amount of money it would take for an organization to have access to our elected officials. Do you believe that the amount, what do you think about that idea? Not do you believe, let me ask a broader question. What do you think about the idea that there's so much money involved? Do you think that flavors people's opinions about lobbyists?
No question, you have the right expression. The elephant in the room is money. Money paid to lobbyists, money lobbyists and their clients give to politicians, creating an appearance of a quid pro quo, which is corrupt. If you pay money and get something in return to a public official, that is a crime on both sides. We have no answer to getting rid of money in politics yet. The public doesn't want to have its tax dollars used to pay for campaigns. We've tried that idea out many times. And yet we're never going to get rid of money in helping to elect people. And we can use the internet to have donations smaller, the way President-elect Obama brilliantly did, but we're still going to have money. So I have no answer. And of course, the more money that one gives, the more campaign events you go to, the more likely it is that you'll have an appointment with the member you have donated money to. So money, quote, buying access is an ugly fact of American political life. And we would like to think that somebody that doesn't donate money would also have equal access. I'm afraid that in many instances that is not the case. It should be, but I'm afraid sometimes more money buys more access. The ultimate safeguard is transparency. We ought to at least know how much is being given, how much is being paid, and most importantly, what is the ask? What is the lobbyist asking the member of Congress to do? Then we can all judge for ourselves whether when the member votes one way or another, it's an act of causation or an act of correlation, meaning is he or her doing the right thing, or is he doing it because they were paid this donation?
Do you think the incoming administration will have people who were once lobbyists in it?
Yes. And I respect greatly President-elect Obama. I'm excited about his presidency. But I really did believe that the generalized policy against lobbyists giving campaign contributions often struck me as overbroad.
Lanny Davis joins us here in Studio 3A. His op-ed, Lobbyists Are Good People Too, appeared in today's Washington Times. He's a lawyer with Orrick Herrington in Washington, D.C. Thanks for coming on down.
Thanks for having me.
This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Allison Stewart in Washington.